Welcome to Songcraft, Spotlight on Songwriters. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to our show via Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also hear streaming episodes on Spotify. To receive a bi-weekly email with new episode announcements, sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com.
You can also keep up with us via Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for one word, Songcraft Show. To find out more about how you can help support our mission while getting access to bonus content, exclusive contests, and other extras, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/songcraftshow.
You're listening to an instrumental version of Save the Best for Last, a number one song for Vanessa Williams that was written by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Wendy Waldman. The Grammy nominee and ASCAP Song of the Year winner will join us in a few moments to chat about her wide-ranging career and multi-genre songwriting success.
Part 1.
Before we start today's episode, I just want to speak directly to our listeners, and I want to get a show of hands from who's been with us from the start.
That's pretty good.
All right. Well, so all of you who raised your hand are probably very familiar with our website at this point.
Yes.
We got something new for you. A brand new, shiny, magical,
streamlined,
incredible,
improved
website. Yeah, it's new and improved. It's fortified with 19 essential
vitamins and minerals.
It's part of a healthy breakfast. The Songcraft new website.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was, we used to have our website with a company called Host Baby, which was related to CD Baby, if you guys remember that organization. And Host Baby, sadly, is no more.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Host Baby only told their customers with about 3 weeks' notice, hey, we're pulling the plug, but don't worry, we're moving you over to this other company. Automatically.
Yeah.
And that company sucked. So we had to rebuild our website kind of from scratch in a very short period of time. It caused much stress and anxiety.
I'm going to go ahead and give you the credit for this.
It was me. I was being generous.
Yes.
But yeah. So I rebuilt our website.
We have a new website. You made a new website.
And now I think it's a lot more streamlined, which also is more user-friendly. And we've done some different things that make it easier to browse and discover all our episodes. But no, I'm actually really excited about our new website. I think it's, if you go to songcraftshow.com, right on the homepage, the very first thing you're going to see is the current episode. Then you're going to see a list of our most popular episodes right there. So if somebody's new to the show and you recommend it to them, they can just dive right in on the homepage.
Yep.
We've got a separate page for recent episodes. And then we've got, of course, a page for all the episodes from the very beginning. Jim Peterick, number one, episode one, all the way up to current episode with Wendy Waldman. We're 135 episodes in. Can you believe that?
Good Lord.
Yeah. And still, hopefully, many hundreds to go. But yeah, so check out our new website, songcraftshow.com. We're excited about it. It's more streamlined. It's hip. It's exciting.
It's
healthy. All the things we are.
Part two.
Well, in addition to all the website excitement, we've got a giveaway today.
Yeah.
We've got a good looking hat.
Yeah.
We've got a good looking hat with a logo on it. It says Pearl Snap Studios.
Yep.
If you know anything about our podcast, or you've spent any time listening to our stuff, then you know Pearl Snap Studios are our dear, dear friends. They help us get a lot of these episodes on the air, and they've helped a lot of you get your music from point A to point awesome.
And that could be their new slogan.
Yeah, from point A to point awesome. That's what Pearl Snap does for you. These are guys that can take a very, very simple demo, like an iPhone demo, and turn that thing into a legit sounding commercial song that you can pitch, that you can give to your children as birthday gifts. What do people do with songs nowadays?
Yeah, that's an excellent one. Your significant other.
Valentine's Day is coming up in about 360 days.
Right. Yeah.
So get ahead of that rush. But PearlSnapStudios.com is, after you visit SongcraftShow.com, head right over in a new tab to PearlSnapStudios.com and see what they've got to offer you.
Or if you want to use the original tab, you can save the .com part. You don't even have to retype it. Just erase the Songcraft Show part and plug in the Pearl Snapper.
Time saver.
Yeah. Yeah. So for those of you on the go, actually, we know we have a lot of listeners who are Pearl Snap customers, yeah. I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Clients of Pearl Snap. A number of people who listen to our show have had some great demos made there. And so I think that those are the kind of people that are going to be interested in this hat giveaway.
Yeah.
Now, it is about a 4-foot sombrero. No, just yeah. kidding. It is a baseball cap. It is a quality baseball cap.
It's navy.
It's navy blue with a nice white Pearl Snap logo on the front.
It's polarized.
It looks cool. I'm a baseball cap wearer myself, yeah. as you know.
Well, you can't win this contest, though.
Yeah, but I'm ineligible because I'm part of the Suncraft staff.
Yeah.
So someone else is going to get the chance to walk away with this hat. So what we're going to do is say, go to songcraftshow.com. The new website aforementioned.
Yeah.
Scroll down to the bottom. There's a contact form there where you can contact us via that website. So hit us up and let us know that you're interested in the Pearl Snap hat. And basically, next episode, we're going to give it away. So we'll just randomly draw somebody. So, hey, man, free hat. Why not? Just go ahead and put your name in.
And you know what? Even if you're not interested in the hat, which why wouldn't you be? But even if you're not, you know, don't be shy about hitting that contact button. We'd like to hear from you guys. We like hearing your thoughts on the show, especially if they're positive. We'd like to hear your suggestions for guests and things like that. And, you know, maybe we'll read some of them on the air. If you write something that's horrible and super lame, we'll definitely read that one on the air and hang you out to dry.
Yeah.
But if you write something super nice and super cool and thoughtful and insightful, then we'll probably share that too.
And if you do have suggestions for guests, it's even more helpful if you know that guest and you can put us in touch with them.
Yeah, just reaching out and say, how about you guys do Paul McCartney is yeah. not helpful to
yeah,
us.
We thought of that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I feel like we have sort of this embarrassment of riches today. We're giving away hats. We got new websites. Things you know, are happening.
We went to Chipotle.
We went to Chipotle for lunch. There's a lot of energy, you know, happening today.
Totally.
And so we've talked about Patreon on here before, and we're not going to give you the Patreon pitch.
No.
We're just going to say that this interview that's coming up with Wendy Waldman, we went over to her house, we had a long conversation, and it was way longer than a typical episode of Songcraft, so we weren't able to include it all. So we decided, you know what? Why don't we let people see how we make the sausage? So we're going to give you our Patreon subscribers. And if you're new to the show, Patreon, if you go to patreon.com/songcraftshow, Patreon is a site where people can kind of become sponsors or members of what we do here. But for any of our members at any level, even the $2 a month level, if you want, you can go and hear the entire raw audio, pre-edits, pre-song insertions, pre-cleanups, including yeah. mistakes. But you're going to get deeper insight into Wendy Waldman, her past, her interesting career that's kind of reached into all sort of areas. And you can kind of get a sense for what goes into creating this show, because we do edits and we you know, tighten things up. And
we had some bad mic cables this
yeah,
time.
We had some bad. You're going to hear some crazy sounds on some mic cables. You're going to hear me stop mid-interview because I had to go pee. That happened. But you know what? Why hide it?
Right.
We're just going to let it be on there.
Yeah. I just wear a spacesuit and adult diaper every time, so I don't have to do that.
That's. I wondered why you wore the spacesuit. It's all to obscure the adult diaper.
Yep.
So yeah, if you want to go on there, you can hear like the full-on, full unedited, absolute like raw materials of Songcraft in its purest form.
Warts and all.
The other thing that's really cool that we're posting on there is not one, but two recordings by Wendy that we did that day. Live performances. She does an acoustic guitar version, just acoustic guitar and vocal of Save the Best for Last, her probably best known song. And then she also sits down at the piano and gives us a new song from her forthcoming album that's not even out yet. So we're talking like world premiere.
So some really good stuff for our Patreon supporters this time. I feel like some lucky person could pull this off, walk away with the hat, hear all the material on Patreon.
Yep.
And then probably still have an opportunity to go to Chipotle themselves.
And nobody's going to stand in line at Chipotle and not look at their phones. So while they're at Chipotle, they can be checking out the updated version of songcraftshow.com.
Oh my, did we just describe the perfect day?
The perfect Songcraft day.
Is there any other kind?
Amazing.
Part 3.
From recording artist to musician to backing vocalist to record producer to multi-platinum songwriter for other performers, Wendy Waldman has a diverse music industry resume. Though her father was a film and television composer who wrote the Perry Mason theme and worked on classics such as The Twilight Zone and Star Trek, Wendy was drawn to the blues and folk music at a young age. Her first serious group was Brindle, featuring Carla Bonoff, Kenny Edwards, and Andrew Gold. Though they split up before their first album was released, all four would be instrumental in Linda Ronstadt's success, and would reform in later years to record three albums that are now regarded as modern-day classics. Wendy's solo career began when she signed with Warner Brothers Records and released her first album, which Rolling Stone magazine called the singer-songwriter debut of the year. A series of critically acclaimed releases followed before Wendy relocated from Los Angeles to Nashville, where she found commercial success with Crystal Gayle's number one single, Baby What About You, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's chart toppers, Fishing in the Dark and Home Again in My Heart, as well as top 10 singles for Lori Morgan, the Forrester Sisters, and Nicolette Larson with Steve Warner. Always difficult to pigeonhole, Waldman's achievements on the country charts were rivaled by her success in the pop world, where she scored with Don Johnson's top five single Heartbeat and Vanessa Williams' Save the Best for Last, which reached number one on the pop, R&B, and adult contemporary charts, earned Wendy a Grammy nomination for Song of the Year, and was named ASCAP Song of the Year. Wendy's songs have additionally been covered by Patti Austin, Kenny Rogers, Reba McEntire, Cher, Alison Krauss, Randy Travis, Percy Sledge, Kathy Mattea, Aaron Neville, Rita Coolidge, CeCe Winans, Bette Midler, Johnny Mathis, Judy Collins, Restless Heart, Barbara Mandrell, Tanya Tucker, Patti Loveless, and many others. Wendy, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you very much.
It is great to be here in your very cool studio at your house.
Thanks a lot.
Well, so many of the people that we talked to on the show grew up, you know, somewhere, some town. They loved music, and then they made their way to New York or Nashville or Los Angeles to find their path in the music industry. But I understand that you actually grew up here in L.A. in a family of music professionals. Talk a bit about your background and your early influences.
Making my way to L.A. meant getting my mother to drop me off at the Ash Grove when I was 15 because I couldn't drive yet. And I wanted to see every blues act, in particular, every folk act that came through. So that was a drive over the hill. There wasn't a 405 yet.
Right.
The famous 405. My father was a composer from New York who migrated out to L.A. with television. At the height of his career, he wrote the Perry Mason theme.
Wow. Mm.
And he wrote a lot for Rocky and Bullwinkle, and then he wrote the Bullwinkle show.
Wow.
So he wrote all that music. And he wrote for Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, all those shows.
Wow.
And he had, you know, decades in TV.
Yeah.
So that's where I came from.
And how did this begin to translate into then you kind of, you know, taking the distillation of generational talent then into doing your own things?
These guys in the 50s and 60s all lived up and down these foothills. You know, they lived in Encino or Sherman Oaks, or a few of them lived on the west side. And my father was, since he had achieved some fairly high status, they played chamber music at our house, live chamber music.
Wow.
All these great players, you know, like the A players.
Right.
Armand Kaproff and all these guys would come over, and these were all A guys that he would call for his Friday tracking as well. And they were a very close-knit community. So here's my family. Everybody's playing chamber music, you know. Dun, da, 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 da. Freddie, 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 go back to bar 36. I don't think that's an E flat, you know. What could I do but become a blues musician? So Dad would get this pamphlet every month of the Grammys of records that had come out, and you could get the vinyl for $3. So when this is how old I am, when Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues, with its orange cover, was released on CBS, and I was 14, maybe 15, I saw it, and I checked it off. Daddy, will you get me this? Will you get, you know? And I every month I would check off records,
wow.
And then I started going to the Ash Grove when I was about 14, 15. And one day I was 16 and I saw Taj playing solo.
Wow.
I kept thinking to myself, there's something, there's a sound, there's a feeling. And I never knew what it was because I had this complication of hearing classical music, but being a rebel and learning to play and, you know, being a guitar player and, you know, having rebelled against the obligatory piano lessons that every Jewish girl had to take in those days. And I saw Taj sitting by himself on the stage at the Ash Grove playing the resonator, and he played Karina. And I died and went to heaven.
Hmm.
So here's these, you know, I've always lived with that dichotomy. But I went full on into early pop music, and I was here for the exciting years when the soup was thick and complicated and nobody knew what was coming.
What do you remember about your first songwriting attempt?
Oh, I was 14 and I was sitting on my bed playing a guitar that my sister had willed to me because she was sick of studying classical guitar. And I wish I had that song because I know it was terrible. But I started writing songs because the problem with the blues for me was that it was only three chords.
Hmm.
And I'd already heard Ravel and Gershwin and Debussy. So I was like, this is boring. So I need to write. And so I wrote and wrote and wrote. And I went to the Troubadour every Monday night to, we had the hoot where you arrived at 3 o'clock, which meant you cut school. And you sat outside on the sidewalk. And I was usually like third in line. Jackson Brown was always first because he lived closer.
Hmm.
And all of us would be there. And I got my first encore when I was 16. I played, God, I don't know what I played. I might have played Skip James' Devil's Got My Woman. I don't know that I played something of my own. I doubt it. I'm sure I was playing one of those. By that time, I had met Maria Muldaur. I had heard the Quesken Jug Band through my history teacher, who became my first husband. I had seen the Stone Ponies at my school because he was very close to Linda, and he was the only person her mother trusted to drive her out to California. So Linda Ronstadt came to California with Ken Waldman.
Wow.
So I had met those guys. I had already seen Kenny Edwards. I was 16 when I saw Kenny Edwards with the Stone Ponies at our school, and that was another one. I looked at that guy and I went, gonna be in a band with that guy.
Huh.
That is my soulmate.
Well, eventually you did just that. I mean, you put together a group with Kenny and with Carla Bonhoff and with Andrew Gold called Brendel. I'd love to hear how that came together and just about kind of the experience of being a part of a group like that.
Well, first of all, I was in high school with Andrew Gold, whose father was Ernest Gold, composer of Exodus, and whose mother was Marnie Nixon, who sang, you know, My Fair Lady and all that. She was a great, great singer. So Andrew was in the class behind me, as was Elmer Bernstein's son, Peter. So Andrew and Peter and I were playing music together. We had a jug band, Diamond Roscoe's Jubilee Quintet, which Dr. Demento has played.
Wow.
Our version of Chauffeur Blues, which of course we learned from Quesken Jug Band, from Maria. But so I was playing with those guys, and we had seen Kenny with the Stone Ponies, and then Kenny hooked up with Carla Bonhoff and her sister Lisa. And so they were a trio and we were a trio. And, you know, you were doing little things. You were playing little, I mean, the valley was still rural. There were psychedelic fairs and all kinds of fun things to do. And McCabe's hadn't started yet. So we were playing around, and I was waitressing in Santa Monica and playing in between waitressing. I was playing five sets a night, and Chuck Plotkin came in.
Hmm.
Now, I had already decided I was going to be in a band with Kenny Edwards. I was playing in a band with Andrew Gold and Peter Bernstein. Peter went off to Santa Cruz. Chuck Plotkin became enamored of my music, and he came to me and he said, I would like to produce you and represent you. And I mean, I would never do this now, but I did it then. I said, no, if you want to do it, you have to do my band. And he said, well, who's your band? I said, it's Andrew Gold. And I knew that Kenny and Carla were an item. So that was like, and Kenny Edwards and Carla Bonoff. And he said, oh, okay. So I got onto them and said, there's this guy who, do you guys want to do this band? Because he wants, you know. So we put Brindle together and it was crazy. We were crazy. We were children. We didn't know anything. Chuck didn't know anything. This was we were together before the Eagles. Mm. And we had an amazing sibling harmony, you know, even then as messed up children, we had an incredible sound and we wrote terrible songs and a couple of them were not so terrible. We wound up being signed to A&M with Lou Adler, who was Carole King's producer. And he pretty much took out any of the real magic that we had. And we made a single. And by, I don't know, 1970, 71, it was over. And we were playing five sets a night at the Carolina Lanes down by the airport, which is a whole other story. It had a bowling alley, a coffee shop, a discotheque, and a strip joint, all Jeez. Under one roof. And of course, we were all, except for Kenny.
Fun
we
for
were,
the whole family.
We were underage, so we all had fake IDs. Right. And Andrew was the youngest of us, and between every set, he would go back through the kitchen and just stare at the strippers. You know, it was an amazing experience, but it broke us. We broke up. But Chuck kept me. He had signed me, and he said, I want to make this solo record with you. So I went with Chuck. Kenny and Andrew went to Linda Ronstadt. And this was the beginning of, they were already pulling her out of the Stone Ponies.
Yeah.
And she was doing solo records. And that's how Ken and Andrew wound up being involved there. And all of us. I mean, we all sang on those records. Carla wrote a bunch of songs on those records, ultimately. Yeah. We were family.
Family
with her.
Well, Warner Brothers Records released your first solo album, Love Has Got Me, in 1973. And one of your earliest champions was Maria Muldaur, who covered several songs off your debut album, including Gringo in Mexico, which became your first charting hit as a songwriter when her version appeared on the Adult Contemporary chart. Talk about what role Maria kind of played for you as you were establishing yourself as a songwriter.
Maria had, I'd known her through Ken, and I had written these songs, and I hadn't made a record yet. But Maria had heard Vaudeville Man. She had heard Mad Mad Me. She had heard Gringo because I was starting to write well. I was 21 maybe, and I was smoking weed all night and writing songs. And I was just a songwriting fool. I was writing by myself, no collaboration, never even thought about collaborating.
Yeah.
I was an artist, and that was what I was going to do. So she decided with her team to record on that first album. I think they did Vaudeville Man and Mad Mad Me. And that her first charting single was Midnight at the Oasis, and that was that record, and it sold over a million copies. And I was then signed to A&M by Chuck Kay and Joel Still as a writer, but I didn't know what that meant. No one ever explained to me. I mean, I was an artist. So, and then here comes this check one day. And I went and bought a wood-heated shack in Topanga. And at the same time, Chuck Plotkin had been, we had recorded half an album. And we took it to Lenny Waronker, who was Maria's producer. And he liked what he heard. And he said, okay, you go and do the second half. And that was the Love Has Got Me album. And that album came out to this enormous, enormous Rolling Stone review. I mean, it was like, it still resonates to for my career 40 plus years later. Stephen Holden at Rolling Stone heard my record and did a huge the big, you know, photos and pages and pages. He said, this is the singer-songwriter debut of the year, 1973.
Wow.
And he cited Maria, and he went through every track, and he single-handedly put me on the map. So it was a hell of a beginning for me, and it was the most generous thing anyone's ever done for me was that review.
Yeah,
because I sure ain't never had no hits myself as an artist.
Well, you know, that second Warner Brothers album, Gypsy Symphony, includes a song called The Good Love, which went on to be covered by Percy Sledge. And there's a ton of Muscle Shoals musicians on that album. Did you actually go down to Alabama to track that?
Here's what happened. The first album had stunning critical acclaim, but we didn't sell. I think we sold like 35,000 copies, and Plotkin was quite worried because he had, I believe, mortgaged himself into the studio, and there were some financial concerns. And Aretha had just had her stuff out of Muscle Shoals that did really well, and Paul Simon had just cut the and we had a massive disagreement. I said, listen, man, my first album had Kenny Edwards, Russ Kunkel, Wilton Felder, you know, Leland Sklar, Andrew Gold. This was the right record to make. All we have to do is do it again. And I had a slamming stack of songs for the second album. And Chuck overruled me. He said, we have to have a hit. We're going to go to Muscle Shoals. And I said, I don't want to go to Muscle Shoals. I don't, you know, I want to arrange my own music. I don't want to go. Yeah. But I was 23 and I knew nothing. And we went to Muscle Shoals. And of course, psychologically, I immediately contracted massive bronchitis, which didn't leave until we got on the plane to go home. Huh. Now, it was a conflicted experience because I loved those guys in Muscle Shoals. I mean, I was playing with, it was the section. It was Jimmy Johnson, Barry Beckett, Roger Hawkins, David Hood. You know, it was the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, and they were, and Pete Carr. And they were so great. And I loved what they did with the music, even though I was not participating in it. And that's always been very difficult for me.
Yeah.
It's just a fact I have to accept about myself. I had one other experience like that in my life. And at the time, I knew I wanted to cut with Kenny and Andrew again and all these people that Chuck had put me together.
Yeah.
Didn't happen. So in the long run, I mean, and I got panned by the critics because my voice was a mess, and Chuck decided that the feels were so good that he was going to keep them even though I was not well. So that's always been my least favorite record. Ironically, a lot of people love Gypsy Symphony. And the songs are really good. And the feels are, you know, yeah. You know, I'd love to sing it again.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, of course, many, many years later when I saw Beckett again, you know, when I was producing the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, it was so great. I loved him. I had a massive crush on Barry.
Now the world knows.
Well, it wasn't until your fifth Warner Brothers album, Strange Company, that you did hit the Billboard pop chart as an artist with Long Hot Summer Nights. More of a rock-oriented album than the previous stuff. But the thing that stands out to me about that is that you would never today see a major label put out five albums by an artist and the artist not getting, you know, hitting the singles chart. It seems like there was much more of a appetite for development and, you know, that just doesn't exist anymore. And I'd love to get your thoughts as somebody who's been a working musician and artist and writer for all these decades, that you've seen a real shift in terms of what companies are willing to, how they're willing to invest in creativity then versus now. I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on that.
Warner Brothers was the greatest record label for nerd, creative, interesting, eclectic music, as Atlantic was for rock and roll, as, you know, of course, as Ahmet was. And Warner Brothers' position in those days, and most labels' position in those days, was, well, you sign the artist and you're signing the artist. And at some point, you know, I mean, obviously you keep your cost down, but the artist is going to hit. You know, when Randy finally hit with Short People, it'd be a long time. And, you know, Bonnie was on the label. Bonnie never had a hit till she went to Capitol. They just, you know, so the philosophy in those days was you develop an artist. This was the philosophy, but Warner's was the strongest because I think this was some kind of strange magic, but they weren't alone. Everybody did that.
Yeah.
And today's independent labels will do that. You'll see Compass. They'll sign an artist. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? You know, you're signing an artist or you're signing a song. You're signing a record.
Yeah.
And people loved Strange Company. And I was out there playing my 57 Strat. And I was barefoot with my hair out. And I was playing electric. And because I was evolving as an artist, you know. And I was going, well, the same, you know, I kept saying, imagine if the Rolling Stones met Gershwin at Randy Newman's house with Taj, you know, sitting. What kind of music would that be? And that's always been my question. So on Strange Company, I got closer.
Yeah.
I got a lot closer. And the record, people loved it, but Warner's was very unhappy with me because I suddenly was a rocker.
Wow.
I wasn't a nerdly precious piano player. I was out there playing electric and I left.
Yeah.
I walked off the label straight into the demise of pop music in 1979.
Wow.
And the explosion of disco.
Yeah.
So here I went from, you know, the safety of Warner's, and certainly if I had stayed, we could have duked it out, but I was insane.
Well, whatever insanity you had started to look like genius a few years later, because you started having, you know, hits as a songwriter. In 1983, Crystal Gayle had a number one country hit and a top 10 adult contemporary hit with Baby, What About You, which you co-wrote with Josh Leo. I understand that you moved to Nashville, you know, right around that time or shortly after that time. Talk about what prompted you to relocate from California.
I was starving to death in Los Angeles. It was my first time of, like, I didn't have a deal. Now, in those days, if you were a recording artist without a deal, the best thing you should do is tie yourself to a tree and starve yourself quietly and let the rest of the tribe go on, because you are no one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm borrowing $300 a month to pay for my damn house in Topanga, you know, and from my dad. And he says, you know, we all had to go through it. And I wound up working for Val Garay at Record One, which he had built. I was doing background vocals for the Randy Meisner record.
Mm.
And here comes Eric Kaz, who's writing music with Randy. Now, I had met Eric Kaz in the 70s. He had asked me to write twice. And both times, my attitude was, who is this guy? I mean, I'm an artist. I'm not one of those people who, you know, I'm not a Tin Pan Alley person. I don't write for other people. If they want to sing my songs, that's fine. But so 1980, the third time's the charm. 1980, I'm singing background for Randy Meisner on my knees at Record One. And Eric Kaz comes to me and he says, I got to write with this clown. You know, I got to write with him. Do you want to write songs with me? And I went, yes. Yes. So Eric Kaz took me under his wing. I had never collaborated except one little song with Ronstadt for an In Harmony record for the Sesame Street thing. I'd never written with anybody. And for 2 years, Eric Kaz taught me how to collaborate.
Uh-huh.
So we began to have some covers. And without Eric, I don't think I would be here. We had Heartbeat with Marty Balin first. We had Patty Austin, The Way I Feel. We had all kinds of stuff. And then I started writing with other people. I set myself, all you songwriters out there, here's what I did. After Eric, and I was well taught by Eric. After Eric, I said, I will write with anybody who asks me. Period. Because, you know, obviously my attitude prior to that wasn't serving me. So I started writing with friends, and I wrote with Josh Leo. And we wound up with the Crystal Gale record in 1983, Baby, What About You? By this time, I had signed a big-ass deal with Screen Gems in Los Angeles. At the same time, I was given a whole stack of computers and drum machines and stuff by Fostex and by Tom Oberheim, who was an old friend of Ken Waldman's. So I was messing around with drum tracks and synth tracks in 1980, and I was recording them like crazy, and I loved this stuff. And after I signed, Tom Sturgis came and became the head of the LA office. And I took my dance tracks and my synth tracks. And he said, I think you're writing very mediocre music. And I was crushed.
Yeah.
I just signed here, you know, and they're giving, I'm like one of the highest paid writers at Screen Gems, and he hates me. And I'm really loving what I'm doing. God again intervenes. Charlie Feldman from the Nashville office happens into the LA office. And I meet him. And he says, I have a feeling you need to come down to Nashville. And I said, you know, it doesn't matter where I go. I'm in a bad scene here. I think you should come down to Nashville. So I went, what do I got to lose? You know, I better go down. And he brought me down during the week of CMA when the Crystal Gale record went number one, which was 1983. Well, I knew two people in Nashville. I knew Mac McAnally, because Mac had been a fan of mine and we were friends. And I knew Dan Seals from out here. And I remember Mac taking me to lunch, and we were sitting at the place that was before the Sunset Grill. I forget what it was called, but we were sitting there. And all these different writers were coming up to, you know, Wendy Waldman, I've always loved your work. We ought to write sometime. And I was, first of all, in L.A., they weren't doing that. People were not, if you had a contact in L.A. in those days, you didn't share it.
Huh.
And Mac would either kick me under the table like, no, this is not the person for you. And then someone else would come up and Mac would go, hey, you need to know Wendy. I think you guys would write great together. So that blew my mind that there was such a notion of generosity and sharing in those days. Then I met Craig Bickhart, who had just come down, also signed to Screen Gems. And Craig and I started writing, and I started writing with Donnie Lowry and a few others, and I could do no wrong. The doors were open to me. I was a big-ass Jew with a purple leather jacket, and nobody cared because they liked my work.
Yeah.
And within months, I moved down.
Wow. Was it, you know, you had just kind of gotten into co-writing shortly before this, and, I mean, Nashville is a co-writing town, mean, all the way. Was there any kind of artistic growing pains for you as you adjusted to that new mode of work?
No, because I had already done a lot of it, and I knew that going to Nashville was like going to university. I knew I was going to be writing 10, 2, and 6 for years. And I was. You know, I wrote with everybody.
Yeah.
And I wrote hundreds of songs in Nashville, and with Charlie as my publisher, we got a lot of cuts.
Yeah.
And I became partners with Mike Robertson, and I started producing records. And that was really interesting because I had told Lenny Warnker years before, when I was still an upstart little asshole at Warner Brothers, I had said, someday I'm going to produce records for you. Because I always, this was why having these guys come in and produce over me never worked. I was a record producer and an arranger in my gut. So what was ironic to me was that it was Nashville, not Los Angeles, that opened its doors to me as a female Jewish pop-based record producer. But by then, I had written a whole lot of country songs. I had had a lot of cuts. I had sung on Hee Haw. I had worked with Steve Wariner. I had worked with Clint Black. I had paid some serious dues. I went to and sang demos for Even Stevens for nothing. I mean, when I got to Nashville, I went, I'm gonna learn this.
Yeah.
And I learned. So the growing pains for me were more in the style of Nashville composition, and also that it was a foreign country with a foreign language and a foreign value system.
Yeah.
And not so much the music was, you know, that was a breeze, you know.
Yeah.
I had a history in folk music.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning. You know, several people had come down to Nashville and were pulling it away from, you know, from its 70s roots and starting to introduce the whole folk element.
Yeah.
You know, so we were, again, maybe 30 of us came down, Rodney and Roseanne, myself, Jim Photoglow came right after and stayed with me. Josh Leo moved down. Our whole L.A. crowd moved, Vince Melamed. And Larry Lee came in from Missouri, from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, and we all became a family. And that small family had an enormous impact on country music, which resonates today, and no one has written that history. We changed the face of country music. The class of 89 was because of all the influx of all the foreigners and Tony Brown saying, I want these people.
Yeah.
Tony Brown started hiring me immediately.
I think Steve Earle called that the great credibility scare of the late 80s in Nashville.
That's true.
You really had some great success with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Home Again in My Heart was a top five single for them. And then, of course, Fishing in the Dark. You and me go fishing in the dark. Number one song, absolute classic. of your catalog. Not only a huge hit for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, but Garth Brooks has recorded
Thank you, Garth.
In recent years. Yeah, and I think the Garth Brooks cut is kind of the holy grail for any songwriter that ever spent any time in Nashville. We'd love to hear a little bit about
the story
about
of fishing in the dark.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a tragic tale. I was writing with Jim Fotoglow. And Jimmy, I always say Jim came to me, and he was really excited because he had found this lick. He said, "Man, check out what I got here, you know." Now, I'm an old blues musician.
I think I've heard this.
I'm like, and he was a pop singer.
Like, yeah, I think Chuck Berry found that lick.
And I went. And it was kind of, he looked at me like, okay, you know, I've done the heavy lifting. He'll kill me when he hears this. I love you, James George Fotoglow. But I said, okay, we'll write. So I said, God, I got this idea, and I don't know what it means, but I'll give it to you. And I said, oh, well, I just got these words in my head, fishing in the dark. And he said, I don't know what it means, but I like it. So we wrote Fishing in the Dark. And our good friend, who was also struggling and starving in those days, Vince Gill, came and sang the demo. Ed Bruce recorded it first.
Huh.
The next recording of it was arranged by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. And, I mean, we had arranged it, but the Daredevils took it much farther and produced by me. And it was great. And we did, they found Fishing in the Dark in the catalog, and they said, we got to cut this. This is our tune. And they had a slightly slower, but the arrangement that you know is their arrangement. And I took it to Beckett. And he said, I will sign this band. Wow. This is a hit. So we were making plans. Mike Robertson was managing them, and we were ready to go. And I was out in L.A. for this, you know, to visit my folks during the summer. And Josh Leo called me. And I will never forget this. And he said, Waldo, I'm about to fuck you, but I'm going to make you a lot of money. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, I'm producing the Dirt Band. And I'm cutting Fishing in the Dark. And I'm cutting your version of it. And I said, you can't. I said, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils have a pending record deal with Warner Brothers, with Barry Beckett, based on this, on our production, their arrangement, my production.
No.
You can't. You can't. And he said, Ed Bruce already cut it. You can't stop me.
Wow.
And so it came true. It became an enormous hit. And Josh has said very graciously a few times, it was just Waldman's arrangement with a backward snare, and it was the Daredevil's arrangement with a backward snare and a little bit faster. And it was what a conflicting experience.
Yeah.
Because it did become a huge hit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I mean, he was very honest about it, you know. But we've had a lot of fun, and of course I've done a lot of work with Josh since, and but one of the great sorrows of my life was the Daredevils. It's such a fragile industry.
Yeah.
But it, you know, of course fishing's been great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Been great for all of us.
You know, and even at the same time that you're having all this success in country, you know, you continue to have a success in pop at the same time, which isn't always the case. You know, I think of Heartbeat, a top five single for Don Johnson in 86. Oh, Industry, the song on the Beach, the soundtrack credited to you and Bette Midler. How did you manage both of those worlds, you know, and sort of maintain relationship and credibility in both?
Not by design. I never stopped thinking of myself as a pop musician. Never.
Hmm.
I knew where my artistic soul was.
Yeah.
And And even as a record producer, I knew that I was basically an independent style record producer.
Did you always kind of feel like an artist who was writing songs? You talked about that schism a little bit between feeling like a Tin Pan Alley type writer versus an artist.
Well, I challenged myself not to write Wendy Waldman songs on top of these people.
Right.
I really did. I mean, I learned to write lyrics. I learned to write tracks. I learned to play any bass, mm-hmm. any position on the team. I mean, I could do anything you asked me to. I could play a session. I could do, you know, so I really gained the skills. But in my heart, I knew I was not a country writer exclusively. I knew I was a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stuff that I did go through a period where I wasn't writing much by myself. And that was scary when I started again, because I you know, wait a minute. You know who you are. You
right.
have to always, one for them, one for you, one for them, one for you. And this is where the collaborators came in, because a lot of them were real country
yeah.
writers. And so I was smart enough to see what they had and say, okay, this perspective, it ain't mine. But I can work with it, because my job is to perceive what's going on there, not what's going on here. You want to do something on what's going on here, go make a record, which I did.
Yeah.
I made what became Letters Home.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was working for them, I was working for them. I mean, I put on the white stockings and I knew every secretary at every
right.
record company up and down the row.
You know, you've touched on this, but that Letters Home album, you know, brought you back as an artist.
Yes, it did.
You know, wrote or co-wrote every song on the record. But as you say, you produced that album, and it was kind of a rare thing at that time for a female artist to produce her own album. But what was even more rare, and is still, oddly, rare to this day, is for a female to produce another artist.
Yes.
Which you did for the Forrester Sisters when they recorded their version of Letter Home, giving you another top 10 country hit, but this time
as a
writer and as a producer.
Letters Home.
Touched on it, but talk about why you think, you know, you were able to break through Nashville's production glass ceiling, and not just Nashville. I mean, this is across the industry. When to this day, there are still only a handful of examples of female producers producing artists other than themselves.
Across the board. Isn't that interesting? You know, I've thought about it a lot. I made, with the help and support of Mike Robertson, who was my partner at the time, I made Letters Home. Now, originally, by the way, I was co-producing it with Harry Stinson. But Tony Brown came to me and he said, tell me what kind of a drummer Harry Stinson is. And I said, oh, he's great. Are you kidding? And the next thing I knew, Harry Stinson was gone and he was playing for Steve Earle.
Yeah.
So Mike said, produce the record. And I knew what I wanted to do. I mean, I had Michael Rhodes and I had Kenny Greenberg. I was one of the first people to bring Kenny Greenberg into a Nashville studio.
Huh.
You know, and it was great. I had a lot of fun, and it was a rock record. I really loved that record. I'm still very proud of it. And so I made this record, and then people started coming to me. First person who came to me was Pam Mark Hall on Reunion Records.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I love your work and I want you to make a record. And I said, but you're a Christian artist and I'm a Jew. And she said, yeah, I don't care. And Reunion didn't either, although that was quite an experience. And then I think it was the Forrester Sisters. Paige came to me and said, you know, the Forrester Sisters want you to produce Letters Home on them. And it was very funny. I said, it can't be done. You can't make a single out of that. It's a 4.5-minute song. And she said, well, you'll find a way. And so I would say, I cut out all the na-na-na-na sections, and it was literally needle drop vocal to the end of the record, needle drop. Came in at around 4, we wrote 3:15, and we had a hit, you know. And I wound up being low man on the Warner Brothers totem pole, producing half of the greatest hits record. You know, Jim Ed... got to do all the tracks he wanted with all the stingers in that band that he wanted, and I got stuck with the other stuff. You know? And I managed to pull out, on that second record, I managed to pull out a couple of other top 10 hits, I believe. Don't you? I think, I don't remember, you know, that's all the drugs I took as a child. But, you know,
I think there were three charting singles off that.
Yeah. And then the ball was rolling. Then Terry Choate came to me and said, I'd like you to do Susie Boggess. And Paige asked me to do the developmental tracks on James House, which I did. And I mean, I just started producing. I produced for everybody. The record that makes people kiss the hem of my producer's garment is, of course, Newgrass Revival.
Yeah.
And at this time, and it was an incredible record. We cut Friday Night in America. We cut Calling Baton Rouge. The version that you hear of Garth, it's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. We cut that. We cut Plant Your Fields. We cut several things that Garth actually took.
Yeah.
In the same way that he took something else off of the Susie Boggess record, which was a great record and won Academy of Country Music Award. And that record, the Boggess record, was a real challenge for me because I said, I'm going to do this really minimalist record. I'm bringing in, who did I have? I had Craig Nelson, Eddie Bayers, Brent Rowan, and Matt Rawlings. That was it. It was a quartet.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that Susie Boggess record doesn't have any of your original songs on it.
There was no way, because, I mean, I learned to be a producer for, I never pitched my own songs to my artists, ever, because to me, they were two separate jobs. And when I worked with Boggess, there was nothing I was writing that was remotely something that would make sense. You know, look at that record, I mean, it's like a black and white portrait of some real traditional. I mean, we did Sweethearts. We did the yodeling song, you know, the Cowboy Sweetheart, because she was an incredible yodeler. And people were saying, don't let her yodel. I said, you got to be crazy. Have you ever heard this girl yodel? And I had, so I just said, I don't have anything. And I wouldn't have pitched it anyhow, because I was very shy about that.
Wow.
Artists who wanted to record my songs had to say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had an experience where I got to go to every one of those great, great publishers in Nashville, all of them, you know, many times looking for songs for all these artists. And it was a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Killer experience.
Yeah. You
know? That's cool.
And it sort of all came crashing down, as it will. A producer is somebody who's just been fired or is about to be, you know. I mean, that's life.
Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, your story still continued in a big way, though. One of your best-known songs is Save the Best for Last.
Yes.
Which became a number one pop, R&B, and adult contemporary hit for Vanessa Williams in 1992. It's not the way I hoped or how I planned, but somehow it's enough. And now we're standing face to face. Isn't this world? About the journey of that song, kind of from the writing process all the way to ASCAP Song of the Year.
I had started writing with Phil Galston in 1983 when I was still living in LA. And Phil lived in New York and still does, and would occasionally come down to Nashville after I moved. Now, I had also written with John Lind before I moved to Nashville, and he terrified me. You know, and he wrote some of the great hits for Earth, Wind, and Fire. And he scared the hell out of me when I wrote with him, and he wasn't very nice to me, and I didn't like him. And I said, I'll never write with that guy again. Typical Waldman in those days. So, but Phil's coming down to Nashville, and we're writing, we're getting cuts, you know, here and there. And I just was very flippant one day, and I said, I know you're writing with John Lind. You guys are never going to have a hit till you write with me. It's like, I look at myself and I go, you know, I've done about five really forward things like that in my life, and they all were good, but I would never do it if I thought about it. So Phil came down. He had a week with John, and they had their procedure where they would write these endless, they would write a piano thing, and then John would sing a melody, and they would refine this thing and drive each other crazy. And then, so Phil came down that weekend with three pieces of music. One of them was this thing they had called Save the Best for Last, which I thought was just a horrible title. It's like, ew, what is that? That's like so... And then on top of it, they had this really dark kind of New York cynical lyric idea. Like save, oh, yeah, you saved the best for last. You know, you took my record collection, too. It was really kind of... nasty. And I was like, well, okay. I said, look, who's, I mean, I'm living in the land of up-tempo positive, you know. I said, who's gonna sing this? I mean, you know, you broke my heart, you know, I see the rain fall through the trees, I think tonight it's gonna freeze, you know. I was like, who's gonna, that's like, no one's gonna cut that. And he said, well, what would you do? And I said, well, it's obvious, you know, they've been friends, she or he, you know, one's been in love with the other forever, and they were just friends, and then the other one finally goes, oh, wait, I just realized I love you.
Yeah.
Happily ever after. He went, oh, positive. You mean positive? So we wrote that lyric, and I wrote that seven flat thing to the da ba da da da. And that summer, I was back in L.A. to see my folks and stuff, and Phil said, you need to sing the demo. And I said, they tell me in Nashville not to sing my own demos. They never, no, don't sing your own demos. And he said, well, no, I, you know, you're going to sing it. So I sang it. And so then we, of course, in those days, I mean, everybody wanted the Whitney Houston. This is it. We want the Whitney Houston cut. And Clive passed on it because it didn't have a chorus and he didn't think it was a hit. So the song sat around and sat around, and different people looked at it, but nobody wanted it. And then one day, Ed Eckstein from Mercury Records showed up, and he said, I'd like to put a hold on Save the Best for Last. Oh, who's it for, man? It's for a new artist. Ew. I mean, God, if those lessons are like, you know, obviously from that. Young writers out there, if your garbage collector asks to record your song, just say yes. You never know. So he said, not only that, we're going to record it, and it's going to sit on the shelf. Could be as long as a year. Could be two. And at this point, you're going, oh, yeah, right. Whatevs, you know. And he said, because I'm going to build a whole album around it. Hmm. So... sure, whatever. Nobody else wanted it. And he did exactly what he said he was going to do. The record sat on the shelf for at least a year. I'm sure Phil would have better memory than I do, while he built the rest of the record. Keith Thomas produced. I was living in Nashville, so I went down and wrote another song. I wrote Better Off Now with Keith for Vanessa. And... then it came out, and we just watched it go up the charts. Like, it was enormous, and it was at a time when there wasn't any melodic music being played on the radio. I guess that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah,
and it didn't have a chorus, and it took me. This is how out of it I was. And I tell you, I was not an alcoholic nor a drug taker. I'm just a middle-class Jewish neurotic, you know. But at one point I went, oh, my God, I rhymed moon and June.
It's like the thing.
I had never even thought about it. Oh my God, I did that, you know, but I did it in a totally different way.
Yeah.
You know,
that's funny.
And the song became an enormous, enormous
yeah.
hit.
Yeah. Well, when you look at that era, I mean, you, clearly that song kind of became a modern day standard. You guys had Sweetest Days,
yes.
which was another big, you know, pop hit for Vanessa. Then at the same time, you've got Lori Morgan with a top 10 country hit
yeah.
with Half Enough. So you really got this sort of pop country thing. But you ultimately left Nashville and moved back to California. What kind of prompted the coming home?
It was personal. I was married. I had just been fired by Bowen from the second Susie Boggess album. You know, and Bowen, the story of Bowen and his takeover of Nashville is a long and complicated one, and I ran afoul of him. I had turned him down when he wanted to hire me as a record producer. This was years prior. He said, there's going to be a woman producer in this town. I think it's you. And I want you working for me. And I said, well, Bowen, you know, I'm flattered. I'm already working for every label as an independent. He had rules that were very, very strict. And you got well paid to do two things. Exactly follow his recording rules and stand up to his humiliation in public. And I knew that he had humiliated Tony. He had humiliated a lot of people. And I was the first woman he was looking at. And he made me a very generous offer. And I went home, and my husband and I at the time, Brad and I, walked around the block, and I said, you know, this means I can get a red Jaguar just like Mom's, and we can have a house on the hill with columns. And but Brad was, you know, in his defense, was an old rocker from Berkeley. And by the time we got back home from our walk, I said, I can't do that. Yeah. I know what's going to happen. I can see it. I've seen it. And more importantly than any kind of public humiliation is the fact that he has rules about how you make records. And that, because I mean, I probably could have cried my way through the humiliation, but the fact that these are the five mixes that you're supposed to put in my mailbox each morning, and this is the snare sound, and this is, and your singer does five takes, and the second comps that vocal.
Yeah.
I was like, I've comped every single vocal that every single artist of mine has ever sung. Period. And yeah. I still do. Only now I don't have an engineer. I do it myself. I looked at that and I went, I can't make records like that because I couldn't do it. So I turned him down. So, of course, I was working primarily at the time for Capitol. I had finished Newgrass and Bowen came to Capitol. And I knew when he got to Capitol, I was just about to start mixing the second Boggess record, which was a great record. I remember over the holidays, Alan Reynolds and I called each other because, of course, Alan had had some history with Bowen on a certain record called Baby, What About You? The first record of Crystal Gayle's that Alan hadn't produced in decades.
Yeah.
In 1983. And Alan and I compared notes, and I said, how do you feel, first of all? You've got this Garth Brooks guy, you've got Matea, Bowen, who was Alan's worst antagonist, you know, had now taken over Capitol, I guess, which was where Garth was at the time. And Alan said, this Garth Brooks, he said, this young man, I mean, I'm really telling stories out of school because what does it matter? You know, I love Bowen. I've come to really like him, but, you know, this is my side of it, you know. Alan said, this young man is very impressive. This young Garth Brooks fella, he said, I'm feeling really good. I think we're okay. And he said, how do you feel with Boggess? I said, oh, I'm toast. I know it. I said, I don't have a prayer in hell. And sure enough, after the holidays, James Stroud, who had done, was a wonderful drummer, by the way, if you remember. Wonderful drummer, and I'd done a lot of demos with him. But now he's a record producer, and he's Bowen's attack dog. Comes to me and he goes, "Wendy, I'm real sorry to tell you this, but we've just canceled your mix time at Emerald on Bogus. Mr. Bowen doesn't feel that material's there."
Hmm.
And I was like, I ain't surprised.
Jeez.
And so here I am. I've just been fired. And my husband at the time decided he was going back to California. And I had a 9-month-old baby.
Wow.
And I had his daughter, whom I had adopted, back here at CalArts in her first year. And I just went, she had already lost one mother.
Yeah.
Her mother had died. And I just, here I am going, well, I'm probably going to bounce back on my feet. I'm going to produce more records. But I couldn't have my family destroyed. Yeah. So I came back to LA and I couldn't explain it to anybody. It's just like, I gotta go. And a lot of people at the time, she went back with her tail between her legs, which was not true. I just didn't, you know, I couldn't. So I came back to a city that I didn't know, a style of business and music and culture that I no longer knew. I was a Nashvillian. I wrote like a Nashvillian. Right. I thought like a Nashvillian. I didn't know anybody. And my marriage was slowly slipping away. And by chance, I ran into some old friends named Kenny Edwards, Carla Bonoff, and Andrew Gold. And we were at a party. And for some odd reason, we decided to get back together.
Wow.
And it was, even though we never had hits, it was worth every tear.
Yeah. Wow.
to make those two records and to get to make music with Kenny and Andrew again.
Yeah.
It was worth it.
Well, you mentioned Brindle and you guys, you know, kind of coming back together. One of the things that I find very interesting about you as a writer and an artist and producer is in some ways you have this singular vision and you operate really great as an island, but you also have this really collaborative spirit and you know, it's rare to sort of see that somebody really being in their element in both. And I want to ask you about a couple of albums that you've done in recent years with a new group known as The Refugees, because that's another example of, you know, the collaborative spirit coming in. Talk about those projects and what those have kind of done for you creatively as opposed to working in isolation.
I think that all of that has its root in the fact that I've always loved great musicians. I learned that from my dad, you know, and I learned that from seeing them out there as a kid and as a blues musician and, you know, just being always. I mean, when I started cutting records in Nashville, I was stunned at the greatness of these players. And you know, it's a wealth I have been educated by, you know, 100 phenomenal players from Michael Rhodes to, you know, to Chet Atkins. And I think that in combination with learning to be a co-writer and also having put Brindle together. I mean, Brindle was my way of not doing a solo record and my way of finally engineering Kenny into getting into a band with me. It was that simple. I really wanted to make music with that guy because the way he played, the way he sang, just spoke to me so deeply, and it still does, and it always will, and it did when I was 15, and it does it as I'm 60. So so I've been in two bands in my life. One was Brindle, and the second, which I started, and the second was The Refugees, which I started. And it was simply I just wanted, in the case of Brindle, it was just a primal thing. I just need to make music with these people. These are my brothers and sisters. And we, you know, we, the four of us, were very active in the growth of California country music. You know, we sang on those records. When I came out here and I had nothing and I began to work with Brindle again, I started to get involved in writers' nights, because I had been at the early writers' nights at the Bluebird and I'd played countless writers' nights in Nashville. And so I became involved in the community in Los Angeles, when Billy Block first put together the Western Beat. Brad and I were instrumental in it. Actually, Brad's words were Western Beat, and Billy took those, and I played Highland Grounds every month. And even, you know, the LA Weekly would say, you can see someone like Wendy Waldman at, you know, every month. And I was religious. Like, if I'm going to be out here and I'm going to starve and I don't know how this scene works anymore, I'm going to go out and play writers' nights and I'm going to help develop that. And so Brindle played writers' nights, and then the thing began to grow. I started going to Folk Alliance, and I had met Cindy Bullins, and I didn't know Deborah Holland, but Deborah Holland got in touch with me, and she had had Animal Logic, as you know, with Stanley Clarke and Stuart Copeland, and of course, everybody knows Sid's history. So we got together with another person, and we were just playing, and I said, how about an all-girl group? It's just ironic because Sid is now he. but we, you know, we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of laughs. We made each other laugh like crazy, and we decided to be a band. And we became part of the new folk acoustic movement, which is house concerts, folk clubs, Folk Alliance, regionals, if you're lucky, festivals. And the Refugees went out there, and we have great sounds.
Break free.
We toured until I couldn't stand it, and I quit. I am the asshole that did that. This was after the second record. I was beginning to be so hungry for more music, for keyboard music. I didn't realize at the time, but I wanted to go study, which I subsequently did. I went to school and studied classical music, and I was getting really frustrated, and we weren't making money, but we were folk musicians and we were respected, but we also were very funny, and we did a lot of shtick, and some of the more serious folk people didn't like that. You know, there's orthodoxy in every field.
Right.
But generally the Refugees, I predict, like Brindle, will endure. When we got together, we were all pretty wounded, and we healed each other. We really did. I was wounded. Kenny was still alive, but he had turned me down to be a duo. And I had really felt that if he and I mean, when he and I would play these duo shows, people went crazy, and I kept saying, man, I think, you know, I mean, we had it. We were like the Glimmer Twins. We did brilliant work together.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, he didn't like my style on stage. I was too rambunctious. I was too stupid. I was too over the top. Didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And I was wounded.
Yeah.
Sid was still recovering, even though it had been, I don't know, at the time, maybe 10 years or so, the death of her child. And Deborah had been, you know, was now a teacher at Cal State LA. We got together, and all of a sudden I'm playing lead guitar. Wow. And I never would have played lead guitar in Brindle. Are you kidding? With Andrew Gold and Kenny Edwards, and suddenly I'm playing lead, you know.
Right.
And Sid's picking up a mandolin and Deb's playing bass. And we had a fantastic time.
Wow.
So the thing that was great about us was our writing, you know. We just wrote some killer tunes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm still working.
Wendy, thank you so much for letting us come over and spend some time. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, for me too. I've told some stories I've never told in public, so be kind to me, folks.
Let the chips fall.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to stay connected with you, so please take a moment now to subscribe to Songcraft in your podcast app of choice and sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com.
As a reminder, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for Songcraft Show, all one word. And don't forget to check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/songcraftshow to find out how you can help support us. That's patreon.com/songcraftshow.
Thanks, as always, for listening and for your support.